Institute. We have our usual warm crowd. In fact, the Vancouver Institute is very lucky that it's the people who attend are so affectionate. And one of the reasons perhaps is that we make it so easy for you to show your affection when you go out by signing up for the Institute and becoming members. The lectures are free, but we do very much appreciate the affection of the people who come here regularly on Saturday nights, and even the ones who don't come every Saturday night. We have a very interesting evening tonight, but before we begin, I want to make one remark about the history of the Institute. This Institute has been going for 80 years, but we have a person who comes regularly, who was here on the first lecture and was a founding member, Mrs. Evelyn Lett, who usually sits in the front row now. And I want to do something special for Evelyn, that before we meet again, she will be 100 years old. And I think we should, I want to, for the first time in the history of the Institute, sing happy birthday to somebody. So, will you join me? Okay. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Evelyn. Happy birthday to you. Evelyn, all her life, has had legions of friends, and she continues to do so. And the only problem she has is that they keep on dying on her. So she will probably outlive us all and come here for another 100 years. Tonight we have a treat. We have Pat Marchak on her return. Pat has been with UBC since she was a student. She was a student leader in her youth here, perhaps even a radical, an editor of the UBC. Pat has had many positions at the university. She's written many books, has had interesting views on many subjects, recently on logging and on political correctness in the university and whatever. And her books, even her recent one, have been widely praised. You can read the Vancouver Sun. Perhaps one of the greatest commendations for her recent work is that not everyone who writes for the Sun approves of it, but I think that that Pat, in her career, has been called many things. She's been called editor of the UBC, she's been called professor, she's been called dean, but she's never been called wishy-washy. We will hear that tonight. We have a special treat. She's going to talk to us tonight about universities after a millennium, wither or wither.
How do I? I was supposed to get the clip for
yes.
This one.
Yeah, that's my job.
And I can just walk around with that.
Yeah.
Excellent. Can you hear me? No?
No.
No. Good heavens. Can you hear me now? Okay.
Okay.
That's fine. Thank you very much, Eric, for that introduction. And Peter, I would like to thank Peter Nemetz for discussing with me the topic for this evening and informing me by going and looking up the Encyclopedia Britannica that the first university was in Fez, Morocco, in 859. And actually, universities could be much older than that if you want to include the philosophical schools of Athens. I'm fond of saying somebody might find another institution that and challenge me on this, but I think the universities are the oldest institutions, with the exception of the Roman Catholic Church, in the Western world. And so to contemplate any really serious downsizing or change in them is something that many of us who are devoted to them would find most distressing. And I thank you very much for coming this evening to think with me through some of the problems and issues that we are dealing with in universities, not specifically or only this university, but rather universities much more generally all around the world. Universities really are under fire these days. From all quarters, where they're being accused of failing to teach well, or failing to teach the right subjects, or failing to drop some subjects, depending on people's ideological perspectives, of being elitist, of being too democratic, again, depending on point of view. And then there's the linkage with the Western civilization, and there are both cheerleaders and mourners who believe that Western civilization, Western culture, including universities, is in decline. But I'm going to talk tonight, I'm going to start talking anyways, around the subjects of the technological revolution and the kinds of impacts that that has on the university, about demographic change, and about globalization, all of which are having impacts on this university. Now, if you can just show me how to put this on.
Yeah, you might want to raise the mic. I think we're losing it.
Is that better at the back? Okay. Oh, better put it on the right way. Probably be easier to see. Good. Well, the technological revolution. Obviously, we have a technological revolution ongoing, and it's affected every other institution. There's no reason why it would not affect the university. And to some extent, we're dealing with it incrementally. We do have many professors who are becoming retrained in how to deliver information and are using multimedia and interactive computer techniques. And in fact, I would think that a young professor looking forward to a full career at a university right now would be well advised to put a lot of time into learning how to do that and become an expert at creating blockbuster lectures and series of lectures on their topics, because certainly that is going to be in our future. The notion of people still standing in rooms like this and lecturing in an old-fashioned way is something that's going to very quickly pass by. The multimedia, the interactive computer techniques allow education to occur in a very large number of subjects, not all. There are some where certainly you still need hands-on professors and students, but in a very large number of subjects, particularly the undergraduate years, can be carried on by an interactive computer with video. I'm trying to learn a particular language right now, and I've discovered that working with a computer, which beeps at me when I make a mistake, and which beeps at me quite loudly if I keep making the same mistake, and keeps track of it, and brings it up again 8 lessons later and says, "Do you know it yet?" It's very effective, and you can also put that together with a soap opera, which is now being shown on Channel 5, to let me hear the language, and it's quite a remarkable way of learning a language. But languages are not the only things that are being taught in this fashion. You can learn the whole of Shakespeare this way. You can learn a large part of my own subject, which is sociology. You can certainly learn economics, and you can learn a lot of the sciences, with the exception of those which really do require you to be in a lab. When this is the case, and when this becomes widespread, as it is becoming already, there clearly are going to be new institutions offering education. And they're going to be private institutions, and they're going to be catering to niche markets. For example, they'll cater to different markets in different languages, something that the university really cannot manage to do. And they're going to be undercutting big universities like this with module courses produced in this way, so that students can take these courses at their own time, in their own way. And the only question that's really going to arise is, how do we get credentials for this? Now, until very recently, universities and colleges have had a monopoly on credentialism. And it's been very important, because after all, in some of these subjects, people could have learned from the television 20 years ago. You can learn a lot about nature from the television. You can learn a lot about other cultures from television. But no television station could offer you credentials for doing this sort of thing. Obviously, as the technologies develop, we're going to have to give way on credentials. We'll find that there are wholly new diplomas and new ways of guaranteeing that people have actually learned something in this process. So we're going to see, I think, the end of the crafts guild. And I use that term deliberately because I think the university is the last of the craft guilds. We still have our masters and our journey persons and our apprentices, and it's still a very hierarchical arrangement where one expects the masters to know something more than the apprentices. But when you've got this new kind of technology and a new way of learning, that's not necessarily true, and that craft guild is breaking down in the same way that craft guilds broke down a long time ago in most other fields. Now, clearly there's going to be faculty opposition to being replaced by machines. And faculty members are not incapable of being militant and litigious, and they have tenure, and there is going to be a battle over this, and there already is a battle over this in many other universities. In fact, UBC has been much quieter on this front than many other universities. The faculty are going to argue that you need hands-on relationships. You need a lot of interaction, that a real education takes place in the forms of constant interaction between people, between faculty and students, between students and students. And I agree with them. I think that's absolutely true. But I also think that that's an ideal situation which has already passed. And you can't compare the ideal with the possibilities of the new technology. When we're already dealing with very, very large classrooms and more each year, because we're being pressed by governments and the population to take more and more students, and the only way to do it with shrinking faculty numbers is to pack them in. So that interaction has already been so very severely weakened that that argument it becomes a bit problematic. So the question is, how essential is human interaction, and how realistic are the objections? Oh. I'm going to talk very briefly on this one because I'm sure that you all read newspapers and you know how pressed we are by government decreases in funding for universities. And that's happening across the world. It's not a peculiar act of one government, and I'm not trying to pick on any one government. The government in BC is cutting back. The government before it cut back. The government before that cut back. And this has been happening since the mid-1980s. And I don't see an end to it, because we all know there are some very serious fiscal problems in the economy at large. But also, there's a very serious question for governments about how much is too much. When do you finally stop funding everything? We're facing a good deal of comment from the general public, but more particularly from business and unions, and it turns up in a document called the BC Labor Force Development Board report, arguing that money which is now spent on liberal education, and that is in particular the arts and sciences, should be redirected to vocational training or skills programs, professional programs. There have been some very excellent rebuttals of the arguments in that report, one in particular by Bob Allen of our economics department, who has demonstrated using Statistics Canada data that it is still true, as it has been in the entire post-war period, that people who get a bachelor's degree 10 years later are earning more, are more likely to be employed, and are more likely to be employed in jobs that they wanted or in close to their interests than people who have vocational training only. It was a very good argument, but I think the prejudice at the moment is very much in favor of vocational training and getting people ready for a labor market, and thinking of education as being a training for a labor market rather than for an education for life. One of the responses to this kind of pressure, this pressure from government, pressure from business, pressure from unions, and the decrease in funding and the technological revolution, all happening to us at once, is to start thinking of students in different ways instead of thinking of them as apprentices, people one is supposed to educate, one is supposed to teach. There's a considerable pressure from inside the university to start thinking of them as consumers or customers. Now, you can immediately see both some benefits and some problems with that. For one of the problems is that customers are always right. And you try to evaluate someone and give them a failing grade, or even a grade that won't get them into law school, as is the favorite phrase of students who get low grades, when they're being treated as customers. And I'm not telling you something mythical or way off in the future. I'm telling you something that's happening right now. We do get the arguments from them. Well, just a minute, you know, I'm paying high tuition and I expect to get through here and I expect to get the grades that I want. Now, there are two different streams to this general process, just general way of thinking. One is a model which was in the newspapers about a week or two ago, referring to business schools, our own at UBC, but also business schools elsewhere, which are developing, particularly at the master's level, not so much at the PhD and the undergraduate level, a model of education as part of a marketplace. And it's actually the businesses and employers who are the customers, who are designing the education with the expectation that they will take the graduates if the school succeeds in producing that kind of education, that specific tailored variety of education. And so the students are actually subscribers. They shop around to decide which of these newspapers they like best, as it were, which of these programs they're going to take. And the schools are run as businesses. The second model is something that we heard about a lot in the 1960s, and then it disappeared, and it seems to have come back again in almost the same form. And in this one, there's a sort of lampooning of old-fashioned ways of dealing with students where the faculty thought of themselves as teachers. And they thought of students as being empty vessels, and you produced some objective knowledge which they picked up and did something with. And that version is seen as old-fashioned and old hat and not acceptable way to treat the students. Now the faculty are supposed to design educational environments. And they're supposed to be something like reference librarians. They'll inform students where they can find the information if they're asked. But it's not their job to impose their versions of what is excellent or what it matters in a subject or what's important on the students. That's up to the students to decide. So there's no such thing as objective knowledge in this version. Knowledge is constructed in a personal context. I take that quotation from a brochure which actually did come onto my desk. Now, when you've got that, do you abandon evaluation? Because how can you judge somebody's competence if all knowledge is subjective? Why is that? Is it not showing? Or what?
I'll hold them.
Okay. Thank you. That's much easier. Should have asked for that before. When we went into the post-war period, you'll remember that the economy was expanding. It was fantastic. The group that went through in the 1950s, and I was part of it, so I remember that if you got your bachelor's degree, well, you were set for life. You would have no trouble getting a job. You could pick your job, really, and you could move up the ladder pretty quickly because it was a very small generation and a very big expanding economy. So we were very fortunate. And one of the things that was happening at that time and happened further in the 1960s and 1970s was the expansion of the university. It was a very affluent period, and we expanded in all directions. We added diplomas, we added degrees, we added disciplines, we added new interdisciplinary programs and centers and institutes. All universities did this. They were all growing magnificently in all directions. And because we really didn't have to, we didn't make any choices, not serious choices. Well, I mean, we did not teach basket weaving, as some people have claimed. At least to the best of my knowledge, universities weren't teaching basket weaving. I didn't come across any such course. But we did teach a very wide range of subjects, which sometimes overlapped, and there was some duplication, and some of these subjects were a little weak academically, although some were very strong. I mean, we did do some wonderful, innovative things. But we probably did a lot of things that weren't the best use of money, too, as happens when you've got a lot of it and you're just, you know, growing. And that was all very well. And there was a great democratization of education. Lots of people were able to come in. They were welcomed. It was a great expansion of the middle class, and universities became the route, the mobility route, into that larger economy. There were some defects to all of this, but they were offset by all the benefits of this democratization and lots of education going around. One of the defects was that the bachelor's degree lost its market value because it was much more widely possessed. As a consequence, more and more students had to take graduate training in order to arrive at the same spot in the job market. And graduate schools, of course, kept expanding too. And so we have very, very large graduate schools. And have we got another problem? No? Okay. We have very large graduate schools, we've got a large proliferation of programs at the undergraduate level, and all of a sudden, the funds stop. And governments say to universities across the continent, cut programs, vertically cut programs, cut faculty. Cut them whichever way you want, by seniority, by competence, by program, but cut them. Because we can't afford these great big institutions that have been created. And no university knows how to do that. And as you know from reading papers, some universities have tried it by cutting programs, some have tried it by cutting faculty on a seniority basis or something of the sort. Some have attacked tenure. They've tried a variety of things, and every one of them has ended up in a big mess. Most of them have ended up with some very nasty strikes, which have interrupted the whole process of education. So it is not an easy thing to do, to downsize an institution like this under these circumstances. And we're reeling under this kind of problem at the moment. During that same period of time, from the 1950s to the 19—until the present time, there's been an enormous demographic change in the university, and it has changed the sex ratio of students and the ethnic composition of the student body. This is some indication of the change in sex ratios. In the faculty at UBC, in the faculty, and it's no different from other universities, the same thing has been happening everywhere. In the faculty of arts and education, women students are approximately 66% of the undergraduate population. In the faculties of science, law, medicine, and commerce, they're about 50%. In the applied sciences, they're lower, but you can see from the bar there that even there, they are going up and steadily going up. In the graduate programs, in the majors programs, women are about half of the population and a little lower in the sciences. They're in the PhD program, they're about a third, but steadily going up. So the ratio has changed dramatically. And obviously that's going to have an impact on the way in which classes are conducted and the way in which the university is conducted. It's a very, very different place than it was in the pre-war period when a majority, not all, but a majority of students were relatively young single males. And the university now is certainly not that kind of university. As well as the change in the sex ratios, there's a huge change in the ethnic composition, just as there is in our society at large. Our society has become much more heterogeneous, much more interesting, and there are many more languages, and the university has likewise become a much more heterogeneous institution. But we're facing a very serious problem with respect to languages. We have always insisted at this university, and most other universities in their various language jurisdictions have insisted that students be competent to communicate in the dominant language of the institution, and in this one it is English. And we have demanded that. We have entrance tests for English proficiency, and we insist on it. In fact, the Faculty of Arts put forward a motion a couple of years ago which said that in all classes in the Faculty of Arts where written work was required, faculty would apportion some part of the grade for communication skills in English. This was to make sure that people didn't complain that they were getting marked on their English when they wrote a philosophy exam just because they couldn't write English was no reason why they should have a bad grade. Well, now we have a serious problem. If we're going to be a heterogeneous university, multicultural university, do we also have to be multilingual? And how could we be multilingual? I mean, it's impractical, it's impossible. Because although we might be teaching many languages in language courses, we couldn't have language teachers in biology and anthropology and all the other subjects that we teach for all of those languages. It's just simply not a possibility. So we're faced with a bit of a dilemma there. And yes, of course, there is a bias in favor of those who speak English. There's no question about it. And the bias is much greater in the humanities and social sciences where the communication skills are crucial. And they're less crucial the sciences, math, and applied sciences, but they're still crucial there. So right across the board, we have this problem. And somehow we have to deal with it because one of the claims that is coming at us is that we are, that our teachers are racist if they insist on communication skills in English. Now, either the institutions have to advertise and say up front, with the backing of the population, we teach in this language, and we expect people coming here to be competent in this language, and we will mark in this language, period. And that has to be a very strong statement. Or they have to allow for bad communication skills, and professors will have to know that they can't take communication skills seriously. You can't have it always, and it's not fair to the professors if they're being called racist for demanding good communication skills in the language of the institution. Oh, now we come to a very touchy subject, challenges to what's called the Western canon. We have, as I said, a heterogeneous population, no single cultural heritage. I don't think there is a single dominant ethnic group in this university today, nor in most universities across Canada. It would vary, of course, with the the population of the city in which it's embedded, but these are very multicultural institutions now. And it's certainly true, it's undeniable that the universities in Canada and most universities across North America are very much biased towards the Western tradition, Western literature, Western philosophy, Western history. There are courses of other kinds, of other traditions, but the overwhelming bias of the institution is towards the Western tradition. So the question is, can we change that? Is there a way of changing that? And how do we do it? And should we do it? And of course, we've also had to take into account the fact that the Western tradition has been very male-oriented. And it hasn't included a large number of female writers. Women in history have been relatively ignored. So that, too, has to be taken into account. Now, there have been a great many changes in the curriculum to try to take account of the complaints on these scores and legitimate complaints, since a lot of that Western tradition left out the other side of the story, or left out much of the historical reality for other people. So there has been a considerable response from faculty members trying to update, change, take into account the changing population and changing perspectives on their subject matter. But there are two very different responses to the challenges to the Western canon. One is from traditionalists, and I include myself amongst the traditionalists, so that's my bias. And that is to say, it isn't important that a specific writer be on the core curriculum. What's important is that the overall curriculum emphasizes excellence, quality, depth, is challenging the mind, is obliging the mind to deal with some very difficult ideas and think them through and take positions and then challenge their own positions, becomes much more skeptical. In short, the whole notion of a good education, of an education that develops greater perspective on subjects, more distance, more wisdom, more understanding of other people. If it can do that, then it doesn't matter if it's from another cultural tradition. In fact, fine, we should have different cultural traditions. And we certainly should have both women and men. The other perspective is that there's still a bias involved in all of that, a notion that some things are more important than others. And from this other perspective, which I have tended to call, and I may get hammered for this, popular postmodernism, a view that everything we do is rooted in biography, as it were, is rooted in our identity as women or men, as persons of specific ethnic groups, of specific religious groups, regions, heritages. So we can't rid ourselves of that. And that always comes into the teaching and the choosing of what's on the canon. So that just changing from writer X to writer Y really doesn't get rid of that arrogance that's built into a curriculum. Now, these are debates that are going on in the humanities and social sciences primarily. They aren't going on in the same way in the sciences. The sciences, although there certainly are big debates there about the nature of reality and chaos theory and uncertainty principles and the effect that researchers have on the thing that they're looking at, although those are big debates and important debates, this debate about the ultimate nature of reality is not hitting scientists in their everyday conduct of their work. I think most scientists in the university would accept the notion that there is reality out there. That, you know, there is. There's something out there that's real, and that what they are trying to do is find an approximation of it. They're trying to inch their way towards understanding it, to trying to make some sense out of it. They'll never quite grasp it, perhaps, but they approximate it. They come close to it. And that's, you know, one of the major principles of science, that there is a reality out there. And the other one is that the person seeking it may be anybody. It's irrelevant whether they're, what their gender is, what their ethnicity is, where they live. That those things are totally irrelevant. The process for seeking truth is exactly the same for everybody. So that's a very, very different mindset from the mindset of what I've called postmodernism and the debate that's going on in the humanities and social sciences. If you take the position of the postmodernists, then you have to ask, is there any point in a university? And that's a very serious question. Because if all things are subjective, if all knowledge is subjective, and if students as consumers simply create their own knowledge, if there's nothing objective about the whole process, then your knowledge is as good as mine. Batman surely is as good as Shakespeare. And it then raises the question of what exactly are you doing in the process of learning? Can't talk about teaching since you wouldn't teach if you were engaged in designing educational environments. I don't need to tell you that, of course, there's a history of discrimination in our universities as in our societies, and I think the sexism and racism is not a function of the university, and I'll have some disagreement on that, I'm sure, because I've read things from various others who think it is a function of the university. The university has been involved in that in an active way. I think the university does reflect the society. But does that history imply the impossibility of objective knowledge? And the question finally comes to, can universities possibly meet all the demands that are put on them? Can they possibly make all populations feel comfortable? Can they be totally inclusive? And I'm finally coming to the conclusion that they can't be, that that's probably not on. Not because people have biases, but because there, if you don't see a thing called objective knowledge, if it's all subjective, then no matter what one says, it can cause offense. If I say that Aboriginal people came over the Bering Strait at some point in history, and someone decides that that's not an acceptable version of Aboriginal history, they might take offense. I simply use that as an example. It came up in a recent item in the newspapers. If one says that a particular book by a woman is not a very good book, it might be seen as an anti-feminist comment. In other words, if you don't take this notion of objectivity seriously and work on it and assume that the persons you're talking with are also taking that seriously, then you have a very difficult time satisfying your population. I don't think it's possible to meet all demands. There's another ism that's coming into our universities at the moment, and that is religious fundamentalism, and it's not peculiar to any one particular religion. There are a number of different religions for whom secularism, skepticism, objective knowledge are anathema. And they're not prepared to put up with it. And they do come to administrators in the universities and teachers and complain mightily that the particular version of religious history being given by Professor so-and-so is not the version that they are prepared to accept, and they want that professor fired. Now, you may say that's not on and that's not acceptable, so all the administration needs to do is say, no, that's not on. But if you're being hit by a large number of these things, and sexism and racism and religious fundamentalism are all coming at you with the same claim that you've got to make them comfortable, you can't just dismiss it all. It's a very serious situation for the university. Universities are not microcosms of society. They don't have all the legal framework to try and cope with all these things, and that creates a problem for them. Finally, universities and intellectual life. A lot of the complaints about universities are coming from people in universities, from faculty members who are saying, look, we've tried so hard to make everybody comfortable. We're so tied up in worrying about zero tolerance, about sexism, about racism, about fundamentalism, about students as consumers. And we're being hit so much by money problems, and we're trying to look to please these legislators who want more vocational training and so on, that what we're really offering now is more and more pablum. We've given up on a core curriculum. Well, we gave up on that in the 1950s. We've given up on really rigorous, tough teaching. In fact, we're even saying, you can't teach. You're just supposed to stand there and be a reference librarian. So there's a lot of unhappiness within the institution from traditionalists who think there is such a thing as objective knowledge. And that's a conflict, obviously. It's not a universal opinion. It's a conflict that is going on campuses. And some of the critics from within would say that what's happened to us is we have a paralysis of the spirit. We've lost our way. We've lost our identity. What kind of an institution are we any longer? What do we stand for? And they point out that nowadays we have mission statements. We used to have missions. The mission used to be to seek truth and to disseminate such truths as we found or as close as we came to them. And there was no question. That was the mission. So we didn't need to have mission statements. Now we have mission statements. And I'm going to be critical of my own university. Our mission statement is to be world-renowned, and another version of it is to be second to none, and I can't find any content there. I don't know what we're supposed to be renowned for, or second to what in whom. I mean, what race is it? I still think that we should be seeking truth to the best of our ability, fully understanding that in the humanities, we have probably got to look for something that's called quality. Matthew Arnold, who of course is thoroughly debunked, called it the search for perfection or the search for sweetness and light. Will the university continue? I think it depends entirely on whether we're prepared to defend that tradition of truth seeking. If we're not, then we don't have a unique role any longer in the society. We're simply one more institution competing with private institutions that are going to be hitting all the niche markets, and we're going to lose out. Our strength lies in sticking with that old mission of truth-seeking. Thank you. Do I keep this on?
Sure. Pat Marshak continues to have strong views which she expresses even when she isn't asked, but she's also willing to be a learning situation catalyst. And now, for those of you who have questions, we will have our usual question period from Pat. Yes, Robert first.
I'd like to ask a question on the subject of tenure to which you referred. My question does not relate to this university. I'm concerned about the concept as it applies to universities generally. You've spoken of changes in attitudes toward tenure. What would you like to see happen in this regard for the future in universities?
Should I repeat the question? The question is, what would I like to see happen with respect to tenure at universities in general? And Dr. Clark was emphasizing that he didn't mean specifically at this university. But clearly, any answer would refer to people at this university as well as any other. Well, you know, tenure has been an important thing in the past for protecting freedom of speech. There's no doubt about it. And for those who think that that's an unimportant thing, I can think of at least three cases where individuals said very controversial things and did need some protection. And I think tenure did protect them, and I don't think we should underrate that. On the other hand, I think that we have now got a large number of protections in the in legislation external to the university, job protections, and I'm not convinced that tenure as we have developed it is the best way to proceed any longer. On the other hand, I think people have to plan long-term research strategies. And so we can't, I hope we do not ever get to the point where we're hiring people on a yearly basis. I think that's very hard on sessional lecturers right now. They can't plan a research strategy. And universities, after all, are not only teaching institutions, they're also research institutions. So we'll have to come up with fairly long-term contracts which are renewable with review.
Pat, you know, on that matter, we still, I think, fortunately, I say this as a retired professor, have compulsory retirement, which renews the institution. But for most of the universities in North America now, that has disappeared. And that's perhaps the greatest threat to tenure, is in some sense the greed of the faculty in not retiring. And at these institutions, I'm talking of the Harvards and Princetons, many other institutions, there's serious consideration about removing tenure because the importance of renewing the faculty with the young professors coming in. Next question. Yes.
You mentioned the reduced funding of the university. At the same time, when I walk around the campus, I see huge buildings go up. I see a parking garage on Marine Drive that must have cost a few million dollars. And I wonder whether it isn't better to spend the money on the actual education and keeping the tuition fees in reasonable limits than putting up grandiose buildings and parking garages.
The problem is that the money is coming from different sources. It's the operating grants that are going down. The money for the buildings is coming from a combination of sources, private donors, and then matching grants from government, which were guaranteed some considerable time ago. And those new buildings you see are coming up on that. And of course, capital expenditures and operating expenditures have different aspects to them in any case. As well, the parking garages are money-making ventures. Yes, people pay $1.25 for half an hour, if my memory is right, and they actually make money. They'll pay for themselves very quickly and then make money, so we're assured. Perhaps some of that money will go into the operating budget, who knows. But it is the operating budget that is the real problem. I'm not quite sure how to comment on that. I don't think I want to comment on Hitler's and Goebbels at the moment. But
repeat the question. We want to hear the question.
Well, the question was what's happening with corporate money and its influence on the university? Well, I have to answer in two different ways. Certainly, there is corporate money coming into the university, and always has been, and I think there has been an increase in certain sectors with some strings attached. By and large, that is going into applied research and specific professional programs. For example, there's a great deal of money going into forestry. There's some money going into pharmacy from pharmaceutical firms. I would assume there's money going into engineering and other professional programs of this kind by large corporations that have an interest in the products. I'm not sure if there is, and perhaps someone in the audience can tell me, whether there's specific funding going into schools of business from the employers who are working on the master's program, or whether it's less a money matter than an influence matter, and I actually don't know, so I don't want to speculate. There isn't corporate money going into the Faculty of Arts, I can tell you that, and I don't need to speculate.
We'll have many more questions, but let me also say that today we have a special treat, that there will be coffee and cookies for everybody afterwards, at which you can actually approach Pat Marchak and ask more questions individually, perhaps, and meet her. But I say that for people who have listened to the lecture and would like that treat afterwards. So now we have more questions. Yes.
Speaking as a mature student, very mature, I'm struck by one of the big virtues of the university, and that is the interplay of ideas, not only between the professor and the student, but among the students. I'm concerned about technology creating people who are sitting in their little enclosures, banging away on a computer, and really having no interplay whatsoever, either with a professor or among a group of students, all doing the same thing. I cannot help feeling that maybe what should be done is at least correspondence among the various distant students. But there's a tremendous danger, it seems to me, in distance education as regards that. Coming back to my own experience, I treasure the years I spent at UBC, nearly a quarter of a century, because of the interplay with students, many of them who were a quarter of my age.
The question is, well, it's a comment more than a question. The necessity for interaction between students and how serious it would be if we lost that with the new technologies. And the gentleman is saying how much he treasured his own education, particularly because it involved that kind of interaction with other students. I have total sympathy with that point of view. I also think that a real education involves a great deal of personal interaction, although I think there are subjects one can learn the other way. I'm not advocating the new technology. I'm saying it's here. We've got it. It's hitting us, and we have to deal with it. I'm also saying that because of the funding crisis and all these other things that are hitting us, we can't recreate ideal conditions for learning. And it's very likely that when you took your education, you were in much smaller classes and had much more, there was a much more homogeneous environment for you, and you probably were, you might have been, I shouldn't speculate on your personal circumstances, but a large number of the students would have been full-time students, and they would have been roughly the same age. And so there was a lot of interaction. But now we're dealing with a totally different student population. Many of the students have jobs. There's no way they could be paying their tuition if they didn't. They rush off campus to do their job, or they try to fit their education in part-time. Many of them have families. They certainly are not all of the same age group. The whole spectrum is there. And so their circumstances are quite different, and it's not just as easy for them to be spending time talking with one another. So we don't have that ideal situation any longer, and we have a new technology coming at us.
Perhaps we should invite our mature student to join the internet and the web, because most of the students do that now, and they are plugged into each other all over the globe. Next. And then
of the harassment, putting a damper on professor-student interaction.
Oh, I missed one of the words.
If you're concerned with sexual harassment, putting a chill on professors, making themselves available to students, do you think that's serious or is it not serious?
I was wondering when that question was going to come.
The
question is, are the charges of sexual harassment putting a chill on the relationships between students and professors? Yes.
they will probably remove the doors from all offices, I think. Yes.
The question is, what do I think of the publish or perish syndrome? And the speaker is pointing out that some people prefer teaching to research, and some prefer research to teaching, and it's hard to get that balance, and there's an enormous pressure on everybody to publish, with the consequence that teaching may get short shrift. Have I got it fairly? Well, I do think that there's a tremendous pressure on people to publish, and it comes out of a different era in a way, and we haven't adjusted to it. I think I probably speak for most deans, believe it or not. I don't think the pressure is coming from the deans. I mean, as a former dean, okay? I think it's coming from below, in the faculty, to maintain this publish or perish syndrome. I could be wrong, but you can test that one. Because it seems to me that a lot of us feel that when we look at these CVs that have 26 articles, and 22 of them have almost the same title, and in the sciences, people pay to have things produced. So in addition to being under tremendous pressure to publish, they have to actually pay money out of those salaries that they get as untenured assistant professors to get something published in a journal, which then charges our library an astronomical sum of money to be stowed, and nobody ever reads it. But the person gets tenure because they've published those articles. Now, I've stated it in the most extreme fashion, but it's true. It is not a very sensible way of proceeding. Now, there are some universities that are experimenting with a new way of doing things and saying the candidate for tenure should produce their 5 best publications, and only 5, and they're not allowed to produce anymore. It doesn't matter if they've written 100 or not. They're only allowed to get 5. They can choose the 5, and those 5 go out for review. And the supposition is that the cost of books to the library, see, it's not just for the faculty members that we're concerned, the cost of books to the library would go down very considerably. The cost of publishing would go down very considerably. And probably the same people would get tenure.
No. Next question. I know there are a lot. Way over there.
This person is saying, what is going to happen when Lester Thurl gives a lecture on the internet? On the internet?
No.
No. Say it again, now, loud and clear, so that I don't need to repeat it. ComSat satellite.
Yes. Anik.
Anik. Okay. Everybody can tune into it for $1. What's going to happen to the university? Well, that's exactly the scenario that I'm trying to bring to your attention. Right now, I know in the humanities that BBC has linked up with a number of other groups, a worldwide group, And they're producing a two-year series of Shakespeare's plays by the best actors and actresses, plus the best academics discussing those plays. And those are all going to be on all the media. And, you know, clearly it's going to be a challenge to universities. How are they going to maintain a whole bevy of experts on Shakespeare when this is available on a commercial basis? And in the first instance, it might be quite an expensive substitution, but over time, clearly, would be a very cheap one. So, sure, the university's got to cope with a very dramatic challenge, technological challenge. And that's why I'm saying, if it simply is going around and around trying to find easy ways to solve these problems, that won't do. It's going to have to insist on it having a very important identity that can't be replicated by just courses or random lectures elsewhere.
Next question, over here.
My question is, if you were president of a university, how would you respond to educational cutbacks in particular? How would you differ from the direction this university is taking?
I'm very happy to say that I am not a president of a university. I'll never be a candidate for being a president of a university, and I wouldn't wish it on anyone. It's an incredibly tough position to be in, and there is no obvious way to handle that situation. I would probably put some money into technology, but the present administration is certainly going in that direction. But I think I'd have to engage the university population at large in a very sober discussion of the kinds of pressures that are hitting us. I think university presidents generally are trying to do that. But you know, it's not an easy thing to do. You get a room filled with people whose positions are different, and faculty who are afraid of losing jobs. And understandably, I mean, it's not a foolish fear. And students who aren't sure what's happening to their education or whether it's worthwhile or whether they're going to get jobs afterwards. So there's a lot of tension in the place. You try to get them to soberly look at what's happening to universities. It's pretty tough to get a sensible discussion going.
Peter?
Pat, you have a number of books available for sale upstairs. Would you care to comment on the contents of any one of them?
Oh, now that was a low blow. Well, logging the globe is about the global forest industry, Peter. And it talks about what the problems are for the traditional northern pulp and paper producers, particularly in a very different global economy with new technologies. I mean, it's not only the universities that are reeling from tremendous change in their environment. On the other hand, there is no corporation in the forestry field that begins to match the university in longevity. So I think this problem for the university is even greater.
But you're publishing more than any of the young faculty members. What's driving you?
Okay. I don't know.
More questions. We have time for a few more questions. Tony?
Yeah, I want to come return to the technology business. I mean, we're talking about using technology to change teaching. And I think one of the responses of technology to change teaching is technology can change the students as well. I mean, when you get a program which can teach, then you can get a program which can learn. And you can have the program replacing the students and the program replacing the But I really think the challenge for the university is replacing the administrators with programs.
That's a comment, not a question.
I have a core question for you. Would you consider the technology allow you to bring back a core curriculum, and should it?
I don't think it's possible. And I say that because every single university has tried it at one time or another. And, you know, even Harvard and Stanford and so forth have found it just falls apart. They can't get the faculty to buy into it. They're always arguing that something else is really more important. Or they run into this fight over whether it's the Western canon and whether everybody's being properly represented. The question is, will the general education, the Bachelor of Arts degree, become inaccessible because of cutbacks and because of tuition fee increases? Well, I definitely think that the great expansion period and the great democratization of universities is at an end. I think that the combination of tuition fee increases and cutbacks will make education, higher education, generally much less accessible to the population. Simultaneously, in the population at large in Canada and elsewhere, the middle class is being squeezed. And although there is a class of people at the top who are getting considerably richer, a larger number of people are moving down, and the difference intergenerationally is very substantial. That is, the children of the middle class are not living at the standard of their parents. A much larger proportion of the population has fallen into poverty or below the poverty line. So that, too, will decrease the accessibility of higher education for the population.
But there was another point to the question, Pat, I think. He's also asking if you can visit a university without a liberal arts core, and I think one cannot.
Oh, I'm sorry, did I miss that point, the question?
But without the liberal arts degree or liberal arts core, of course, the university is not a university.
That's my opinion, yes.
Yes.
Well, the question of art, liberal art, is that in Europe, Bachelor of Arts is Bachot, and it's a college degree, not a university degree.
Well, no, I wouldn't agree with you. I would argue that a good, rigorous arts degree is every bit a university course. Now, it may be given in a college, but it is a university course in the sense that it is demanding of the intellect at a very high level. The question is, do I approve of the advertisement which for a new president, which calls for, which says it will recruit especially from the minority groups, from women and from minority groups? The Civil Liberties Association, I understand, has come out in favor of a change in the wording and has strongly recommended to the university that it use wording hereafter in advertisements that says including women and minority groups rather than especially. And I think that probably would be a wise idea. The word especially is extreme and probably unnecessary. On the other hand, I have to tell you that I do think the leveling of the playing field was required, and these groups did not apply at an earlier time and are now applying, And in fact, what we're seeing happening on recruitment is a fairer representation of those groups. In the Faculty of Arts, for example, we have hired in the last 6 years between 20% and 30% women, which is very much higher than we were hiring in the previous decade, and it does represent the proportion of women in the recruitment pools. It differs by discipline, obviously. And that seems to me to be perfectly reasonable, and we're not hiring them on a favoritism basis. That is, they're not being hired because they're female. What's happening is that we're increasing their possibility of being considered by the advertisement. We're ensuring that there are more people in the recruitment pool who have a chance to be considered. That's, you know, I'm in favor of that. I wouldn't be in favor of quotas, and we don't have quotas.
We'll have two more questions before the questions will adjourn to the coffee area. One back there.
No, I don't think so. I don't think CBC will survive either. I mean, if you've got a series of private institutions, you're very, very dependent on who the donors are and what they want. And we're already finding this out with our big campaign to obtain funds for buildings. We have already realized that although a donor-driven might be too strong a term, certainly donors make demands, and there are strings attached, and you have to negotiate these things, and you frequently get buildings that weren't quite what you most needed. I mean, it's very hard to get someone to give a building for just plain old classrooms, for sort of mundane everyday lectures. Nobody gave one, actually. But we do have some very nice new buildings for some very fine things, but not what are fundamentally necessary. Also, when you do get these donated buildings, you then have to get matching grants, which means that that money isn't going into the classrooms. So you're very lucky if you get someone like a Walter Kerner who will give the money to a library, which was desperately needed, but you don't get a lot of people like that. You're very lucky when you have donors like that. And if you had a privately funded institution, you would be very much at the behest of those who are providing the funds. In addition to that, a university is an extraordinarily expensive undertaking. What we're going to see instead is privately run businesses. Donors aren't going to give money to a university for a huge university operating fund. They're going to run businesses for niche markets. They're going to run programs that undercut universities. They're going to make money out of it by using the new technologies. That's already happening. And it's happening all over the world. We can produce a program here and give it in Taiwan, or vice versa, and undercut the universities in either place.
We could ask him to send his offspring to the Ivy League universities at $30,000 a year or something like that. The public education is still very important. The last question over here.
I hope not. You know, I do think we're facing serious problems, but I'm still inclined to say whither rather than wither. And I do think that there's a tremendous dedication to a liberal arts education, hopefully by those who have gone through it. We still need it, and there still are business people and government people who know that it is irreplaceable. It's something that enlarges the mind and creates a philosophical turn of mind and a skepticism that is absolutely essential. As a matter of fact, let me end with a nice note. because although the government seems to be following the BC Labour Force Development Board report, there was an item in the newspaper recently in the Sun, which mentioned that Glenn Clark had told an audience that the most valuable thing was to have a liberal arts education, and he was grateful for it, and mentioned in particular political science, international studies, and what was the humanities one that he mentioned? Anyways, he'd benefited from this.
Thank you very much. Before I ask Cole Harris, before you adjourn outside, first of all, to show your affection to the Institute and sign up this year, and also to perhaps participate in with Pat and the affair outside afterwards. Let me mention that there is no lecture next week for Thanksgiving. That's our traditional stance. For those in the audience for whom the Vancouver Institute is such a ritual, if you feel you have to do something like that every Saturday night, I urge you to acquire a book and read it next Saturday night. Come back 2 weeks from now. We will meet again here when Professor Dominic Recapta will speak on history and memory, the shadow of the Holocaust. I will now ask Cole Harris to wind up the evening by coming and thanking Pat Harris, by thanking Pat Marchak for the lecture tonight.
Well, I have really three thoughts in listening to this lecture. One is just at this day and age, how enormously difficult it is to administer a university, particularly a faculty of arts. A faculty of arts, which basically is about what we are as peoples and cultures, what we have been, is vulnerable to the bottom line pressures of our day. It also, in a sense, focuses the social and cultural tensions in a society. After all, faculties of art study those tensions. People feel passionately about them. And then, as Pat Marchak has been saying, the intellectual paradigms are in flux. All of this makes running a faculty of arts just an enormously daunting business. Not everyone, by any means, Pat, you, as you know, has agreed with everything you have done. But I think we have all agreed, we've all known that Pat brought to the Faculty of Arts enormous intelligence, enormous dedication, enormous commitment to the university, and above all, to a precious institution, a beleaguered institution, such as the Faculty of Arts. So I want to thank you for that, Pat. My second observation is that, in a way, having spent all those tough administrative years, in a way, one doesn't need to write a book like this. One doesn't need to come and give an institute a lecture. It is a measure of Pat's enormous energy and courage and commitment to the university process that she does these things. She could be off on a sabbatical somewhere and just leaving this university behind. But the fact that she's here tonight and giving us a lecture like this seems to me to be an indication of the sort of courage, the sort of stamina and energy that Pat has always had. And then finally, when she asks what in this day and age does the university stand for, and says that, well, really fundamentally perhaps it stands for truth. I guess my response to that, Pat, would be to say that in a sense we can leave truth to the philosophers, that they've fought over truth for 2,000 years, and some of them think there's truth out there, and some of them don't. At the moment we're in an age that's particularly skeptical about truth, but that's gonna change. Truth will come back into fashion. But I think a university in a way is more important than philosophical debates about truth. And what a university is really about is somebody who thinks with a very clear head, and thinks out of a base of conviction, out of a wide experience and understanding of the world, and that we've seen tonight. We've seen it in spades. I mean, it's the Pat Marchaks of this world, not the questions of whether there's truth out there, that a university is finally about. And as long as we're producing Pat Marchaks,
a university is going to be in very good hands. So, Pat, thank you ever so much.